All over the world, when people study the area of cognitive development, they begin, or at least they should begin, with the work of Jean Piaget. Piaget really is the individual who is more responsible for launching this whole area of study than anybody else. And personally, it was reading Piaget in the middle 1960s which got me involved in the area of cognitive development. So I have a personal as well as an institutional or disciplinary link to Piaget. I want to begin by talking a bit about Piaget's biography. He was Swiss, born in Switzerland just before the turn of the century, and lived to a reasonably ripe old age. Piaget was a prodigy. He actually published his first paper when he was 11 years of age. It was an observation of an albino sparrow, which he saw outside his home in Neuchâtel. And by the age of 14, he'd published so many papers in biology that he was actually offered jobs by people who had no idea that he was still a pre-adolescent. It's a bit like the joke nowadays on the internet, nobody knows I'm a dog. Well, as long as Piaget was just publishing papers as a kid, nobody realized that he hadn't even been to secondary school yet. Piaget always thought of himself as a biologist rather than a psychologist, and that's important to bear in mind because psychologists claim Piaget is one of theirs and biologists usually don't. So Piaget's self-image was different from the image that the rest of the world had of him. But from a very early age, from the time he was a teenager, he had a goal, which was to try to explain the nature of knowledge, that being primarily a philosophical question: what is knowledge? What does it mean to know? Or you could say it's a psychological question, because once you talk about knowing, you're talking about an organism that knows the world. But for Piaget, these were biological questions, and if we wanted to put it a bit cleverly, we could say, how can a piece of protoplasm know? That would be the biologist's question. Or how can DNA know? How can a gene know? How can a cell know? How can an organism, which is mostly water and tissue, how can such an entity know? That's a good question. Piaget probably wasn't the first person to ask that question, but he was certainly the person to ask it most seriously and to dedicate close to 70 years of thinking and writing to the question of how can a living entity know and know new things, contribute to knowledge, because of course knowledge isn't static, it grows. And sometimes people say the question Piaget was really interested in was the nature of new knowledge. How can one come to know something new? Piaget spent his life in Switzerland. That's perhaps important to know because, unlike every other country in the world, Switzerland was free of war during Piaget's own lifetime. Piaget was actually very concerned about war. As a sensitive young man living during the First World War, he wrote a lot about death and dying and violence. And as a citizen of Switzerland during the aftermath of the Second World War, he got very involved in the United Nations. So we might say he had a Swiss kind of involvement in politics, but he didn't live in countries that were actually in war, though he taught for many years in Paris, and as he got older, did a lot of traveling around the world. I ran into Piaget several times, including attending a seminar which he gave in 1966 in Geneva, and then met him in the United States various times and interviewed him. But he was pretty old. I was very young. I didn't speak French. He purported not to speak English, so our contacts were limited at best, though I wouldn't have had contacts with him at all if I hadn't sent him a paper when I was starting graduate school. He'd actually responded to it, which made a big impression on me and has always stimulated me to try to respond when I get letters from students, even though it would be sometimes easier not to do so. The way Piaget told it, he became interested in what it meant to know, and this was right after the time that the intelligence test had been invented. And so the French world was abuzz with the notion of testing intelligence. And Piaget, like many other extremely talented young individuals, knew where to go. He knew the place to go was the laboratory of Binet, who had invented the intelligence test. And so young Piaget, about 20, went to the laboratory of Binet in Paris to look at how little kids were tested for their intelligence. And Piaget learned to become a tester. He learned what subsequently be called the clinical method of how to draw people out in conversation. But being a genius, and I think Piaget and Freud are the two geniuses of psychology in the last century. I might add a third or fourth, but those two are, they're safe claimants to being genius. Piaget decided that he didn't care if the kids got the questions right or wrong. He wasn't interested in their IQ. He was interested when kids gave wrong answers, what was their thinking? Why were they giving wrong answers? Were they just guessing? Were they being stupid? Or did they have a way of thinking which led them to give odd answers to questions like, what would you do if you found a wallet with some money in it, or what is the opposite of honesty? And this was really a brilliant insight, because when a person gets a right answer, you really can't draw any conclusions. For all you know, somebody whispered the answer. But if they give a wrong answer, especially an answer which nobody has given before, then that's an indication to you that they're thinking about it in a different way. And if you're at all psychologically oriented, you're going to say, why did they give that answer? To give you a Piaget kind of task, if you take an adult or an adolescent and you describe the breaking of a plate which holds cookies on it, and in one case the person wants to give a cookie to somebody else, and in the course of trying to give the cookie to somebody else, he breaks the cookie plate. And in this case, there's only one cookie on the plate. In another case, the person actually wants to steal a cookie, and he breaks the glass when he's out to steal. Let me change the facts for a second, because I didn't get it right. In the first case, where he wants to help somebody, there's a lot of cookies, and they break. In the second case, where he wants to steal something, there's only one cookie. So you ask, in which case did the person commit a worse offense? And for adults who take intention into account, for them it's clearly worse when the person intends to steal the cookie, even if there are fewer cookies that crumble, so to speak. But what Piaget would notice is that for young kids, they just looked at the amount of damage that was done. If more cookies were broken, this was much worse, independent of the intention. So this gives you the insight that kids who are 5 or 6 years old don't think about the motive when they're allocating punishments. They just think about the extent of the crime in terms of damage done. So this was the kind of conversation that Piaget was having with himself and with children, which got him interested in how children think. And as Piaget described it, he wanted to take a detour of a few years to study how human beings thought, and then he would return to the more biological question of how does protoplasm in general acquire new knowledge? How do polyps and mollusks, he was particularly interested in mollusks himself, how do ants and flies and lizards and dinosaurs, how do they come to know the world? Piaget then said, I was going to take a detour for a few years, but actually the detour lasted a lifetime. And indeed, Piaget never exhausted the study of children's minds, and indeed he started a field which now, 70, 80 years after he began to work, is a huge area, and there are many, many, many people studying children's thinking, and we all owe a huge debt to Piaget for having opened the question. Just like people who do clinical work, therapy, owe a huge debt to Freud, even though many of them maybe disagree with the particular claims that Freud made. Incidentally, young Piaget, knowing where things were going on in the world, not only went to Paris to study with Binet and to learn about testing intelligence, he also went to Vienna to meet Freud, and he presented a paper to Freud, and Freud was very interested in the paper. And again, Piaget did this when he was in his early 20s, giving you a sense of what it means to be precocious as a scientist. You find out the people and places where things are happening. You go there and you try to make an impression on them. And indeed, Piaget was given his own school when he was still in his 20s. He was world famous by the time he was 30. And in 1936, when he was just 40 years of age, it was the 300th anniversary of Harvard. Harvard hadn't been founded in 1636. In every field, professors at Harvard were told, pick the outstanding person in the world and let's give that person an honorary degree. And in fact, the psychologist who was picked, who was just 40, was Piaget. Interesting bit of gossip is Freud was very angry that he wasn't picked. Actually, Harvard would have given the degree to Freud rather than Piaget, except Freud was too old to travel, so there was no point in offering him the degree since he wouldn't come. So instead it went to Piaget, who certainly deserved it and probably was a more politically correct choice than Freud, who was pretty controversial in the United States at that time. I divided Piaget's career as a psychologist into three major phases. The first phase, which took place in the 1920s, when Piaget was in his 20s and 30s, and which culminated in no less than five books, each of which were instantly translated into English, which is an enormous achievement because it's very hard for people in foreign countries to get their books translated into English, had to do with the theories that kids came up with about the world. These were books like Language and Thought in the Child, Judgment and Reasoning in the Child, The Child's Conception of the World, and Moral Judgment of the Child. So what Piaget did was to talk with kids about how they understood the world. What does the wind do? What is the wind? Why do we dream? Where is a dream located? What's worse, to do a lot of damage when you're trying to do the right thing, or a little damage when your motivation is ill? Of course, he never used those phrases. He put it in terms of breaking cookie jars or cookie plates. And Piaget just listened very carefully to what kids said, recorded it, and then tried to figure out the thinking that lay behind the decisions that kids made and the answers that they gave. He called the method the clinical method. And the idea of the clinical method was that you try to avoid asking leading questions. You ask neutral kind of questions to see what the child thought without being biased. But then you would test whether the child really believed this strongly by giving counter suggestions. So let's take the cookie example. If the child says, well, Jean is much worse than Camille, because Jean broke 12 cookies and Camille only broke one, Piaget would say, well, but yesterday there was a little boy in the room and he said that actually Camille was worse because Camille was going to steal the cookies. What do you think about that? And by testing the child and see with what tenacity the child held on to the explanation and whether or not the child changed the explanation, Piaget felt he could essentially draw a picture in words of the kinds of reasoning the child used, the kind of thinking the child used. And in these studies, which became world famous in the 20s and 30s, and which led to that honorary degree, Piaget developed a number of concepts. One of the most famous ones was the concept of egocentrism, the notion that the kid sees the world from his or her own perspective and has a great deal of difficulty putting themselves, himself or herself, in somebody else's shoes or eyes or head. Now, you may notice egocentrism is not restricted to kids. Most of us are egocentric some of the time, and egocentrism is nothing that's completely abandoned. But part of growing up, part of developing, and Piaget was a developmental psychologist, is it becomes easier for us to put ourselves in other people's shoes, to see the world literally or figuratively how other people do it. And development, in Piaget's sense, is a long history of decentering, of stopping focusing just on your own interests, your own point of view, and seeing how the world looks to people who are seated in different places and who are, as you would say nowadays, coming at things from a different perspective. He noted a whole set of tendencies in children's thinking with names like animism and artificialism and realism, the fact that kids would treat things which we would call considered inanimate, like a computer or a desk, as if it had a will or a spirit. Realism, kids would often confuse an item with the name of that item, so the name has power. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but for kids, words also have power, and they have a magical kind of importance, and they're not readily dissociated from the object to which they belong. The kids don't see the names as arbitrary. They see the names as part of those objects. Piaget was very interested in kids' sense of causality. One of his five books was about the child's understanding of physical causality, and he found that kids were very quick to invent explanations for things. People had dreams because there's a little man inside the head that's making us dream, or the clouds pass over the sky because somebody is blowing them, or because the clouds want to pass across the sky. And these are all they're all habits of thinking which we would now call primitive. And back in those days, Piaget wrote about this, there was some question about whether children were like what would then call primitives, or perhaps preliterates, individuals who weren't educated and sophisticated like people who lived in Geneva, to which Piaget moved as an adult. Nowadays, nobody takes too seriously the notion that Stone Age man or people who now live in hunter-gathering societies are like children. We realize that it's much more complicated than that. But there's no question that some of these animistic or realistic or artificial ways of thinking are much more likely to be found in uneducated populations, and particularly in societies which haven't developed literacy and they haven't developed science, because science is an attempt to give more rigorous answers to the question of how do we dream and why do clouds move or appear to move and so on. So that was Piaget's first phase. And actually, as late as 1960 or 65, when he was in his 60s, that's really what he was famous for, because those books and explanations were the most accessible. They were in the kids say the darndest things kind of spirit. But meanwhile, Piaget had gone on and done a number of other things which were, in his own mind, at least as important. He began to have children in the 1920s, and he did extremely careful studies of the thinking and the activity. And as we'll see, for Piaget, thinking and activity are not dissociated the way our language suggests that they might be. How his own children constructed knowledge, his own infants, how they came to learn about the world. And for many people, including myself, his studies of his own three infants, Lucien, Laurent, and Jacqueline, are scientifically the most fascinating thing that he did. And you see Piaget is an absolutely brilliant observer, an observer of Darwinian quality, as he does little experiments with his kids. And those experiments, which have probably been done millions of times before, lead him to come up with explanations and theories about the children's mind which nobody had ever thought about before. Indeed, when Einstein met Piaget in the 1920s, when Einstein was 50 and Piaget was 30, and Einstein heard about Piaget's experiments, he says, "So simple, so obvious, only a genius could think of it." And what he meant was, you know, Piaget would hide a duck under a beret and see where the child went. And if the child went for it, he might then take his hand and hide the duck in the hand and move it to a new place and see where the child went. And by that, he came up with theories of how the child thinks the world is organized, how children think place objects have places, and what happens to those objects when they're moved under various kinds of conditions. This was a kind of thinking which nobody had done before Piaget. And we call that the study of sensory motor intelligence in the first couple of years of life. Then, in the 1940s and 50s, when Piaget was middle-aged, and into the 1970s, when he was an old man, what Piaget did was to study how children understand many, many different concepts, concepts which are difficult, like time and space and speed and causality and duration and geometry. And in each case, he would define what we call an end state, what it means for someone to be reasonably developed. Usually this would be a Genevan teenager or adult who had a understanding of space, time, speed, whatever the issue was, which was about as far as anybody can go on their own. And then Piaget would look at the way that those ideas developed in young kids and middle-aged kids all the way to adults. And Piaget's genius was both in creating very clever experiments, the most famous ones of which are the conservation experiments, where a child is presented with two things which seem to be equivalent in amount, and then one of them is transformed in front of the child's eyes, like poured from a thin beaker into a stout beaker, or taken from being a ball and squished into being a pancake, or broken up into little bits. And then the Piaget would ask the child, is it more or less, or is it the same? And this opened up a whole universe which showed that children are not conservers. They are seduced by what things look like rather than knowledgeable about the history of what happened to them. Because if you can distort anything, if you don't add or subtract to it, it remains the same amount, but children until a certain age don't see it that way. The conservation experiments are just one of dozens and dozens of different kinds of experiments which Piaget very cleverly created, and then used the performances of 5-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds to draw what we might call a developmental trajectory. And he looked through the child's answers to the reasoning that the child had, and then he developed theories about what's the mind of the 5-year-old, what's the mind of the 8-year-old, what's the mind of the 12-year-old. And that's the beauty of Piaget's system. He was the first person to try to give a portrait of how kids of different ages think. And he never said the kids were stupid. He said they had different ways of making sense of the world. And there's no way in which you can understand a child, let alone teach the child, unless you have some sense about how the child makes sense of the world. The meaning of these words, operation, structural, and functional, is not easy. I hope that they will emerge in your reading and in my talking. Operations are the thinking that children do inside their head rather than operating physically on the world. And when I talk about structurally and functionally, what I'm arguing is that initially, and really until late in his life, Piaget tried to describe the mental structures, which we ought to think of as mental architecture, which children had, which allowed them to think about things in certain ways. But in his later years, Piaget became more interested in the actual dynamics, which allows somebody to solve a problem in one way, and then over time solve the problem in a somewhat different way. And the reference to function here is an interest in the flexibility of structures and how they change, rather than simply in defining the structures in a kind of algebraic way. Now, one of the things I realize in talking is that there's no easy way into Piaget. There's no way in which to say, here's the 3 of the 5 things about Piaget. And most textbooks are fundamentally deceptive because they just say, oh, Piaget talked about 4 stages, or Piaget talked about 4 concepts. And they give you the illusion that you understand what he's saying. But in fact, Piaget is a whole way of thinking. And it takes a lot of reading and a lot of thinking to really get into that territory. It is a whole world view. Moreover, Piaget didn't make it easier because his writing is at best pedestrian, and at worst obscure, and yet when you're willing to spend time in it, it's really exciting because you see a brilliant mind at work trying to make sense of a territory which was initially very, very obscure. So my own advice to you is read Piaget, read what other people have to say about Piaget, John Flavel, Hans Firth, my own chapter on Piaget and The Quest for Mind. Ginsberg and Opera's book is a bit of a primer. It's easier than Firth, and not it's kind of good for a first pass, but it's not as profound as Firth's reading. But if you spend enough time approaching Piaget from different perspectives, eventually you'll learn to be able to speak Piaget and even think like Piaget. I think probably the way I think about kids is more influenced by Piaget than anybody else. Vygotsky is a big influence once one moves into education, But for those of us who cut our teeth in Piaget, it remains the major way in which we think about the child's mind. What I want to do now is to try to describe some of the major ideas and contributions of Piaget, and I'm going to almost try to give you a feeling for what he was trying to accomplish rather than give you definitions, because the definitions are better gotten from the reading than from my trying to give them to you at great speed. So I hope you'll use these as kind of guides to the reading rather than as a replacement for the reading. First of all, as I've emphasized a number of times, Piaget was fundamentally a biologist, and so he was fundamentally thinking about how living matter operates. And his terms, assimilation, roughly speaking, how a living thing takes information and fits it into the structures, the ways of knowing that ought to exist, accommodation, how those same structures fit to new information in the environment, and equilibration, the processes whereby a knowing system, which is an assimilation and accommodation all the time, reaches a kind of balance. This is something which applies to a mouth that's eating food and a mind that's taking information, these processes of assimilation and accommodation. And we call them functional invariants because for Piaget, they represent the fundamental way in which any kind of new element, whether it's physical or psychological, mental, gets absorbed and then integrated into the ways of knowing, the ways of representing the mental schemes, to use Piaget's own term, with which an individual is equipped at one historical moment. Indeed, the history of our mind is this history of all of our efforts to know something external to the mind and to try to fit that in to what's already there, but the fitting in changes what's already there. So it's a constant dynamic kind of system. For a long time, Piaget was satisfied with these physicalist and metaphoric ways of thinking about knowing. But then in midlife, he became very interested in providing a more formal description of knowing. So there's a famous sentence in Piaget, all psychology eventually leans on biology or on logic. For the first years of his work, Piaget, as a psychologist, leaned on biology, but later on he began to lean on logic. And what this meant is he tried to write out, as it were, equations, the kind of equations that we would have in an algebra class, to describe the operations, the thinking that the child or the adult was passing through. And Piaget, being both original and aware that kids are not logical in the same way that adults are, actually invented his own logic. We might call it a psychologism. And that logic has been roundly criticized by logicians, but in a sense that's irrelevant because Piaget wasn't trying to create a logic that was logical in the sense that a computer solves a problem. He was trying to create a logic which described the logic of the child, which, as I'm trying to indicate, is not logical. It's illogical, viewed from the point of view of the adult. I don't think very many people anywhere, not even Geneva, take Piaget's efforts to create a formal system to describe thinking very seriously anymore. It was too arcane and esoteric, but the attempt has a certain nobility. What's important here is to emphasize the enterprise, which says not only do we want to describe knowing in terms of protoplasm, we want to be able to describe it in terms of X's and Y's, A's and B's, P's and not P's, and so on, the way that a logic textbook would think about things. And in Piaget's arguments with Brunner, a name that will recur throughout this course and throughout your reading, Brunner was really the first person to take a whack at this, at the logic, and say, look, it's fundamentally a mistaken endeavor to try to take thinking and express it in terms of logical propositions. That's not what thinking is all about. I think Brunner probably won that battle, though perhaps not for the reasons that he thought. Piaget was very good at looking at arguments in the academy and laying out a middle ground position. In a funny way, he was kind of, and this is disrespectful to Piaget, he was kind of this psychologist's answer to Richard Nixon. Those of you who are old enough about to know Richard Nixon know that he was kind of a master polemicist. And he would always say, well, there are those who say this, and he'd give some ridiculous notion like we should use atomic weapons to wipe out every communist country in the world. He said, and there are those who would take this position, which is to lay down all our arms and let the communists walk over us. And then he would say, but then the wise people take my position. Well, Piaget would say, there are people who are rank empiricists, which means they think the mind is a completely blank slate, and everything is just kind of impressed on that blank slate and then becomes what we know. And then there are those who would say we're born knowing everything. All knowledge is innate, and it's just a matter of that knowledge expressing itself. To attach some names, which some of you will know, Skinner and the behaviorists would be the complete empiricists. We know nothing at first, and everything is just kind of a reflection of what's in the outside world onto our blank slate. Chomsky and, to some extent, people like Steven Pinker, Noam Chomsky and Steven Pinker, would be the nativists who basically say we know everything we need to know from birth, and it's just a question of its unfolding. Just like puberty takes some years to unfold, so does understanding of algebra. We don't have to really ever study it. It just unfolds. But what Piaget called his position was constructivist, and it's a word that you will see over and over again in psychology and education. And the notion of constructivism is that knowledge is something which has to be built up. It is built up through human activity, but we don't start with nothing. We start at a minimum with reflexes and with these ways of knowing called assimilation and accommodation and equilibration. And Piaget's basic argument is if we have reflexes, which means we look at certain things, we react in a certain way to things, and we have the capacity to take in stuff and either fit it into what's already there or change our own ways of knowing so it fits what already is already there, and these processes of equilibration, if we are equipped with this, we can eventually construct knowledge. And the Piaget was interested in constructing what I call the Kantian categories out of the work of the German philosopher of the 18th century, Immanuel Kant, time, space, number, objects, causality. What Kant said, and probably one oughtn't to have anything that Kant said summarized in a sentence, is we are born as organisms. We have to be able to think in terms of time and space and number. It's impossible for us to think any other way. And he called these the a priori's. They're there from the very beginning. Piaget made an interesting twist on this. He said, we're not born thinking about time, space, and objects in a certain way, but because of the kind of organisms we are and because of the kind of world in which we live, we will eventually build up a certain kind of knowledge of time, space, and objects. And all human beings everywhere will build up the same basic kind of knowledge. So, in a kind of a clever remark, Piaget said, I'm a Kantian, but I'm a Kantian a posteriori. What that means, for those of you who haven't been studying Latin recently, is that after development occurs, it had to occur in a certain way. But you couldn't know, just looking at the organism at the beginning, how it was going to turn out. So you can see it's not an empiricist view, because it couldn't turn out any old way. It had to turn out a certain way. But it's not a nativist view, because it's not determined in the beginning. It only emerges after years of interacting with the world. And for Piaget, and this is probably the most important image for those of you who never knew about Piaget, it's the child exploring the world of objects, touching, feeling, putting them in their mouth, pouring, eating, clanging, throwing. That's the metaphor, or that's the reality of knowing the world. Because when you do that kind of thing, you're assimilating and accommodating all the time, and that stuff eventually becomes your knowledge. It becomes your structures, your operations of knowing. And those early physical interactions eventually can be done inside the head. You don't have to bounce a ball to think of what it's like to bounce a ball, or to toss a ball, or to catch it, or hide something. All that stuff can be done in your head. Not initially. Initially, it has to be done with the physical world. That's what sensory motor intelligence is about. But eventually, we're able to imagine and think about things inside our head, and even to perform quite complicated operations like pouring stuff and unpouring it and pouring it back, all inside our head. Those are mental operations which build upon physical operations which took place earlier in life. So the terms I've used here, hypothesis generation, theory formation, are efforts to say how Piaget thinks about the child. In my book, The Quest for Mind, which I wrote right when I was in graduate school, I talked about the child as a scientist in knickers, knickers being those little cut-off pants that kids wear. And the notion for Piaget is just the scientists are always saying, gee, what would happen if I did this? What conclusions could I draw? That's what the child is saying. He may not be saying it in words, but that's the reason he stretches rubber bands and he throws things and sees how other entities react when they get hit by them. He plays with magnets, pours water back and forth, likes to go on levers and move the fulcrum and things like that. The child is always busy doing experiments and learning from those actions to construct a more sophisticated view of the world. Continuing, our actions are not opposed to thinking. Our actions are thinking. Even reflexes are thinking, and the infant goes beyond reflexes within days of birth. And we learn from the actions we carry out and from the relationships between those actions. I close this, I open it again. That's an action. Piaget would call it an action that's reversed. And after a while, I don't have to do that physically anymore. I can do it in my head, and I can know what it's going to be like. And of course, the things I can do in my head, which I can't do in the real world, and I can think about what it's like to be young again, but I can't become young again. That's a mental operation without equivalence in the physical world. Mental states and actions, mental states and operations, which is what develops over the years of childhood, are all, for Piaget, actions which initially we had to do tangibly in the world, but ultimately now we can do them just in our head. And because they're done in our head, we can do all sorts of things, all sorts of reversings, which can't be done in the mind. Once I crack an egg and it goes to the ground, I can't put it back together again. But in my head, I can put it back together again. And of course, once movies are invented, we can run a movie backwards, and that allows us to do kind of cuter things in our head, because when the medium does that sort of thing, it gives us an idea of what it would actually look like for a cracked egg to go back into its shell once again. And while Piaget's description of intelligence in infancy are these physical actions on balls and berets and ducks and the other nursery elements, more and more, as Piaget describes older kids, the actions are taking place in the head, and they have to be inferred by more limited actions on part of the child or by what the child says. Of course, speaking is a form of action as well, but it's much less dramatic than the actions of hiding objects and trying to find them and so on. The final term here, genetic epistemologist, is actually what Piaget called himself later in life. Initially, he would have said he was a biologist. He never admitted to being a psychologist, but he did call himself a genetic epistemologist. And this is a nice concept, which I think has become increasingly important in recent years, years after Piaget died. Epistemology is the study of knowledge, the theory of knowledge. What is knowing? And we might say, what are the disciplines of knowing? Which for many of us are the academic disciplines. And when you're a genetic epistemologist, you try to study the history, the origins and development of systems of knowing. A genetic epistemologist of the child is trying to understand how the child constructs knowledge, and that's Piaget's major enterprise. But you can also be a genetic epistemologist, say, of geometry or of history. And when you do that, you're interested not only in how a human being comes to know those areas, what is the genesis of those forms of epistemology, but also how do those areas themselves develop? What did geometry come from? What did history come from? What did physics come from? And It turns out that we know a lot about the history of disciplines because disciplines are only a few thousand years of age. We didn't have history or physics or biology until a few thousand years ago, and areas like psychology are much newer. We didn't have psychology until 100 years or so ago. And Piaget became very interested in the history of how these thought packets, these subject matters, we might call them, how they evolved over the last thousands of years. He did a lot of historical reading. And the relationship between how, say, mathematics developed over 2,000 years and how do kids become mathematicians. The way we put it are the stages of a child becoming a mathematical thinker, similar to the stages that mathematics passed through from the Babylonians to the Greeks to the Arabs to the time of the calculus of Newton and Leibniz and so on. And of course, it could be the case that kids and subject matters pass through exactly the same history. It could be the case that they're the opposite histories. It could also be the case that it's much more random. The hypothesis that most people favor initially is that sort of kids are like the Greeks. They have the early ideas and then they develop and become modern day, or in the case of history, or adults in the case of kids. But the more interesting cases are the ones in which the history of the discipline are quite different from the way a child constructs knowledge. Piaget was fond of pointing out that the history of mathematics is exactly the opposite of the way children develop mathematics. And according to Piaget's history, as I remember it, is that you begin with Euclidean geometry, which Euclid developed thousands of years ago, and then you have non-Euclidean geometry where parallel lines do meet, and then you have topology, which is about boundaries and shapes and whether something is closed or not closed. It turns out that with kids, according to Piaget, the development is precisely in the opposite direction. Kids, when they're 3 years old, are topologists. When they're 6 years old, they're non-Euclidean geometers. And only when they become adolescents can they think of Euclidean. Now, I have a feeling that's an oversimplification. Not only am I oversimplifying Piaget, but I think Piaget oversimplified what happened. But at least Piaget established that kids just don't go through the same stages that the geometry went through from 2,500 years ago till today. And in the last 20 or 30 years of his life, Piaget had a center, a centre, on genetic epistemology. Every year he invited people who were experts in a different discipline to come and work there. That's what I attended when I attended a seminar of Piaget's in June of 1966. And Piaget would have all these experts come and educate him about the epistemology of the year, which could be causality or morality or numbers or reversibility, whatever he was interested in. And at the same time, you had these thinkers. Piaget also had legions of graduate students and assistants who would go out and carry studies. One of his assistants, Bärbel Inhalder, became his full-fledged collaborator, and also, I think we can now say, his mistress for 30 or 40 years, and they did much, much work together, and nobody really knows how much of Piaget's later work was Inhalder's and how much was Piaget's. And then, 30 years ago, I would have said Piaget went up to the mountain to write his book of the year, but we can now say Piaget and Inhalder went up to the mountain, left Mrs. Piaget, there was no Mr. Inhalder behind, and together they wrote and made sense of the experiences of the year. Then Piaget, who never rewrote anything, would just hand the book to the publisher, and he would say, well, this next year our subject is going to be, let's say, time, and he would invite all the experts in time, and he would ask all the students to do those experiments, and then he would spend the summer making sense of it. I'm being a bit glib, but as a Swiss kind of a watchmaker of child development, what he was doing was being as systematic as possible, devoting each year to a topic he was very interested in. Now, I'm happy to say that these are topics which we've already covered by and large, and so I'm going to refer you to the readings to get more information about most of them. I do think I should stop at stage and structure because they were so important for Piaget and so controversial. The classic Piaget of, say, 1950 or 1960 took the following position. position was that kids in childhood pass through a number of stages. Every child passes through these stages in the same order. The rate might be different. Some kids who are smarter or who live in richer cultures will pass through the stages more quickly, but everybody passes through the stages in essentially the same way. The stages can be very general, though you can also look at more specific ideas and look at the stages for those particular ideas, but in general these stages are very general kinds of constructs. And the stages are defined by these mental structures. So when the child is at the sensory motor stage, which is in infancy, he or she has got a set of mental structures, ways of knowing, ways of representing the world. And then the child at 2 or 3 enters another stage, which is called preoperational or semiotic or symbolic, various names. And there's a new set of structures, a new set of ways of knowing. And Piaget, of course, realized you had to have a story to tell about how you went from one set of structures to another. But certainly early in his career, he didn't have very good ways of thinking about that. So it might be more like the way you go from one slide in a show to the next. There's a click and the next slide goes on. So there's a click and you get to the next stage. Later in life, he realized it was more complicated. And he also complexified his own view of stages. We'll talk about that several times in the course. But the classic view are these stages which are inevitable, which come in a certain order, and each of them has its own set of structures. And the most interesting claim of Piaget is that when a child is at a certain stage with a certain structures, the child sees the world in that way. And then when a new stage comes in with new structures, the child sees the world in a different way. And these stages are so different from one another that once the child sees the world in way number 2 or in way B, he or she cannot remember or even admit or even believe that they ever thought about the world in form 1 or A. So let's use conservation again. The 4-year-old, you give him 2 identical beakers with the same amount of water, and you pour one of the beakers into a very long and thin beaker, and you ask the child, is there more liquid in the long, thin one or in the, you might say, the comparison beaker? And all the 4-year-olds will say, oh, there's much more in this one because it looks like there's more. It's just higher, and the child doesn't compensate for the fact that it's narrower. If you take a 7-year-old and you say, is there more water in this thin beaker or in the comparison beaker? The child will say, obviously it's the same because you didn't add any, you didn't take it away. And you say, well, you know, you used to tell me that there was more in the long, thin beaker. And the child says, that's ridiculous. How could anybody think that? It's obvious you didn't take anything away or add anything. And so you can show the child the video of the child answering at age 4, and the child would say, well, you're playing a trick on me. Nobody could have thought that. So it's that kind of evidence which led Piaget to say, once the structures change, they really are, you can't get there from here. You can't go back to the earlier ways of thinking. This is not wholly wrong, we say, with the benefit of hindsight, but the picture turns out to be much, much more complicated than Piaget thought. Namely, that much earlier in life, children do have some senses of conservation. Moreover, children never completely cease being non-conservers. There's a part of us which still thinks that there's more because it's tall and thinner and it looks higher. But the classic position is an interesting position, and it's one that people have argued with and railed against for 30 or 40 years. And you draw from that conclusion not that this was a stupid point of view, but rather that it was a very important view, because people do not spend years railing and trying to show somebody wrong unless they think it's very important. And that's a really fundamental notion in science in general, is the most common situation in science is to be ignored because what you say is not interesting or it's already been proved right or wrong. What's interesting in science is when you make a controversial claim, like kids are non-conservers, or kids don't pay attention to intention when they are deciding on punishment. That's what attracts people's interest, and that's why Piaget is important, precisely because people could not have predicted what he found. And perhaps the most interesting and counterintuitive predictions are what Piaget found in his studies of infancy. Piaget wrote 3 books about infancy. The one that really goes beyond infancy is called Play, Dreams, and Imitation. In French, it's called the Formation of Symbols in Children, but in English, it's called Play, Dreams, and Imitation. But I'm referring here to the other book. One book is called The Origins of Intelligence, which was published in France in 1936. And another one is called The Construction of Reality, was published the following year. The third one, The Formation of Symbols, was published in 1945. So these are books from the middle 30s, writing about Piaget's experiments with his own three infants when they were from 0 to 18 months. And what Piaget did in those books was to take the Kantian categories to which I've already referred, time, space, number, and causality, and to shift, and the object concept, which I'll explain in a second, and to show how in the course of 18 months the child developed quite elaborate and in many ways quite satisfactory understandings of those concepts. So became Kantian by the age of 2, even though all the child had in the beginning was some reflexes and these functional invariants of assimilation, accommodation, and so on. The object concept is fascinating because to any of us who are adults, we appreciate that objects exist. Some of them can be reshaped, but something like this is quite firm. And even if though I hide it, you know it still continues to exist. And even if I hide it under three things, you know it continues to exist. And if I move over here, you assume the object moves with me, and so on. That's what we call the full-blown object concept. Piaget discovered that infants do not have an object concept. In fact, what he discovered is that for children, if they're used to finding something in a certain location, like if they used to be over here, and I move it over here, and you ask the child to reach for it, he'll still reach for it over here. And that's bizarre. Even if the child sees it over here, he'll reach for it over here. And even the older child, if I were to place this in a piece of cloth and then move the cloth over here, the child would go back to the original locus of the cloth. So it's clear that the young child does not have the object concept. And I would like every one of you to take a vow that you will spend the hour or two it takes to read Piaget and the object concept, because it's an absolutely brilliant description of what the child goes through in the course of 6 stages of infancy, roughly from stages 1 or 2 in the first days and weeks of life, where the child just has reflexes, and you put an object in the hand, the child will grasp it, but once it disappears from sight, it doesn't exist anymore. Stage 3, middle of the first year of life, child sees something and wants it, disappears, it continues to want it, looks for it, but has no way of knowing how to look, has no theory of where the object is. In fact, the best theory is to scream and hope it will reappear again, as if the scream somehow would bring the object. Of course, the scream brings an agent, namely a parent who wants to make the child feel good. But the child has moved from what we call reflexes to circular actions, where the child repeats certain activities in the hope that they will bring about a desired state. In this case, the recouping of the ball or the duck or the doll or the mobile or whatever it is that the child wants. Now, what has consumed more interest and more paper than anything Piaget ever did was what happens around 8 months. It's what we call the A, not B phenomenon. And that is, once the child gets the idea that something is hidden over here, even if the child sees it being moved to another location, the child will continue to go to location A. And again, this seems bizarre, which is why there have been at least 1,000 studies attempting to demonstrate that the A but not B phenomenon, namely you go to E to A, even when you've seen the thing move to B, doesn't exist. But it does exist. It exists, and infants all over the world around 8 months will exhibit that counterintuitive behavior. And so most people now accept it's true. So the question is, why? And readings by Adele Diamond and many, many other scholars attempt to give explanations of why it is that the child continues to go to A, even though in front of his eyes, her eyes, the object's been moved to B. In fact, even if it's a bee in the transparent lid and you can just see it there, the child, confounding experience, will go to A. And if you think that's bizarre, as you get older, I can assure you that if you usually have your glasses in this pocket, even if you're wearing them, they're over here, you will continue to go there. And in some sense, you are just repeating the A not B phenomenon. We have a very strong proclivity as animate agents to associate things with certain places, even when we should know, because we've seen them moved, that they're not there anymore. Stage five, after a year, the child now will go for something in its current location as long as the child can see it in that location. If, however, as I said, something's hidden and then moved in front of the child to a new location, the child will go back to the original. It's what's called an invisible displacement. The child cannot continue in his own mind to realize that something exists if the child can't see it with his or her own eyes. And again, that is really bizarre. We would all have thought before reading Piaget that if we saw something in a cloth and the cloth moved over here, everybody would say, well, the thing is still in there. Indeed, if it wasn't there, we would assume magic or surprise. But even the 12 to 18 months old child who is now trying new activities to find something, that's what a tertiary circular reaction is, still is not able to imagine in his or her own mind that the object continues to exist. That waits for stage six, what we call the full-blown object concept, which in every normal child will develop by the end of the second year of life, is a child knows that if he saw the object, hide and seek, the object still exists, will continue to look for it until the child finds it, and if the displacements are taking place with the stuff hidden, the child still continues to realize it's there and will go to the last place where the veiled object continues to exist. And that's because for the child, the object no longer inheres in a location or in being able to see it, but rather the child has a theory that objects exist and continue to exist even if they're out of sight, even if they're out of mind, and the child can be rather clever in figuring out how to find the object if he can't see it anymore. The child thinks about all the places it might be and more or less systematically looks there. So the schemes are taking place in the head, the operations are taking place in the head, and in fact, you know, if there are four kinds of shields, and the child doesn't find it on number one, he'll keep looking to two, three, four until he finds it. If he doesn't find it there, he'll look under the table or in the sleeve, clearly, the child is thinking about all the physical possibilities of where the object can be. Because Piaget focuses on action so much as being the necessary antecedent to being able to perform mental operations, to be able to look for things inside your head before you look in the world, there were some very interesting predictions by Piaget which turned out to be wrong. Back in the 1960s, fortunately not in the United States because of a vigilant physician, there was a drug called thalidomide, which women took during pregnancy, and unfortunately the kids who were born of thalidomide parents had very stunted limbs, so they couldn't actually act physically on the world. And the prediction was from Piaget that the kids couldn't act physically in the world, so therefore they would never develop object concepts, nor would they develop senses of time, space, and number, because that involved operations in the physical world. Remarkably, though, kids with thalidomide did end up having the same Kantian sense as other kids without thalidomide, which may sound like the nativists are right and the kids are born with this knowledge and don't really have to interact on the world. But Piaget's recoup, which I think is the accurate one, is the human being is very flexible in how the actions take place. And as long as a child had eye movements, which they all did, and they could watch where things happened in the world, they didn't actually have to touch the things with their hands. Those eyes were, so to speak, touching the world. And even Helen Keller, the famous American who was both blind and deaf, was eventually able to be eventually able to graduate from Harvard, then called Radcliffe, showing that the human mind brain is extremely flexible in acquiring knowledge, even if the usual channels of the sensory organs, or in the case of thalidomide babies, the motor actions, sensory motor intelligence, are impaired. I'm going to quickly mention a few more things and then conclude. If you want to know about the years after infancy, roughly the ages of 2 to 5, the best thing to do is to read Piaget's third book about his own children, Play, Dreams, and Imitation. It's a wonderful book, very difficult book. It's not a book that Piaget ever followed up on, and I think he found this age the most confusing, because it was an age defined by lacks, L-A-C-K-S. In infancy, the child developed this nice sensory motor understanding of the world. In school age, the child developed what we call concrete and formal operations. But in the post-infancy preschool era, according to Piaget, the child was defined by what he couldn't do, that he couldn't perform mental operations, reversibility in the head. The child was still egocentric, and the child didn't have full-fledged concepts. Rather, words and meanings were messed with one another, and if you talked about things like my dog, dog, animal, cat, the boundaries, which for us are quite well-defined, were very fluid, and the child would go from dog to animal to cat to vegetable without any particular rhyme or reason. And Piaget found this very confusing. Piaget also was confused by plays, dreams, and imitations, all of which for Piaget were not logical. And he's a man who loves logic and is looking for the development of reason and science. And so playfulness, imagination, creativity, art were all things which were nuisance categories for Piaget, which I have to admit is one reason why I became interested in those issues, because when the great man does all the heavy lifting and the big things, you have to become interested in what he's not so interested in. I also have to say that while Piaget's work in Play, Dreams, and Imitations is fascinating, probably his picture of the pre-operational child, the child at the age of 2 to 5 or 6, is his most flawed picture and the one which we learn the least about, because Piaget, I think, kind of lacked sympathy with what Selma Friedberg, in a wonderful book called Magic Years, the years of imaginary play, symbolic play, pretend play, the toddler drawing and singing and telling stories. Piaget just did not have much sympathy with that. For him, it was the child learning about chemistry and mathematics and balance beams, which the child of that age is not that interested in. So what happens in school age? If we look at classical Piaget, you have the emergence of the various conservations of liquid, conservations of substance, conservations of area, conservations of volume. These all appear roughly from the ages of 5 or 6 to the ages of 10 or 12 in a certain order. And what's always key is the child realizes that the shape of something, the appearance of something, can change, but if nothing is added or subtracted, it remains the same amount. And this is a very difficult idea for kids to develop, but once we've developed it, it seems very intuitive. Piaget looked at the decline of egocentrism, the capacity of people to take the perspectives of others, the development of concepts and categories which were organized and systematic, so they were like a Mendelian chart rather than a bunch of lots of fuzzy boundaries. Unfortunately, however, almost all philosophy since Piaget was writing agrees that most of our concepts do not have hard and fast boundaries. Only concepts and textbooks do. Most of our concepts are quite fuzzy, and so Piaget's way of thinking was not particularly helpful, except for the notion that if you ask, are there more cows or more animals, a 5-year-old will say there are more cows, and that's clearly bizarre. So we have to understand what Piaget calls class inclusion. How do children come to understand a set which is contained in a larger set? And that's a complex thing for children to understand. When adolescence comes, kids become capable of formal operations. They can already reverse things in their mind, but by and large, what they're thinking about is the physical world. So I may not have to pour something back physically, but I'm thinking about what it would like to pour the stuff from the long, thin beaker into the standard beaker. But what the formal operator does is he, she does what we're doing now. The formal operator is actually thinking about propositions, statements, sentences, and how they relate to other statements and sentences. Does sentence number one contradict number two? Is it complemented? Is it identical to it? Can it reverse what was said? John was kissed by Sally. Sally was kissed by John. These are all things which we do just in the level of propositions. And the closest example is what logic is. You probably all have looked in textbooks of logic, and some of you will have taken courses in logic. And in logic, we learn about the relationships between statements. And the statements don't have to make any sense in terms of the real world. They just have to make sense in terms of logic. So I'm about to dig myself in a deeper hole. Let me instead give you an example here. Let's say I give you these two statements. All bankers are athletes, and none of the counselors are bankers. Your job is to figure out what inferences, if any, you can draw from these statements. This is a very hard question. If you haven't studied logic, chances are you're not going to be able to solve it, though perhaps by hit or miss, eventually you would get to it. If you studied logic, you'll be able to make some diagrams or to write out some statements which will make it easier for you. If you are the kind of person who likes to rise to the challenge, you might want to stop the video at this point and see whether you can make the inference. But since we've already gone about an hour and 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to just show you the inference which logicians tell us that you can draw from these statements. And the inference is one that doesn't seem particularly intuitive, and that is that at least some athletes are not counselors. So just again to show you what it's like to be able to reason on the level of propositions or logic, it's certainly not the case in the real world that all bankers are athletes, but that's irrelevant. We're stipulating that all bankers are athletes. We're also stimulating that we have another group called bankers, but nobody who's a counselor is a banker. And so the question is, what do we know for sure? That's a question of logic. You study logic or you think a lot to be able to get the right answer. And the only conclusion, according to logicians, that you can draw is that some of the athletes, whatever they are not counselors. That is formal operations. We're all supposed to be able to do it by the time we're 14 or 15. A lot of the school kids, probably boys, that Piaget studied were able to do this. I think he then kind of jumped to a lot of conclusions. The truth is most people in most of the world can't do these problems. The deeper truth is that people probably do become formal operators in those areas which they've studied a lot. But if logic isn't one of the areas that you studied a lot, you're probably not going to be a formal operator in the area of logic. At the end of his life, Piaget came to the conclusion that formal operations were not as widely dispersed in the population as he thought, and that people could become formal operators with one familiar content, but not with others. However, as you can see, these are deeply antithetical to the thrust of the Piagetian enterprise, which claims we all go through the stages, and when you have a structure, you can apply the structure to any kind of content. The next 40 years, after these things were stated in the middle of the century, were an effort by many, many people to show the limits of this point of view. In this overhead, I mentioned some of the chief ways in which Piaget has been criticized, and I've already touched on these before. Most people no longer believe that these stages exist with the kind of clarity and unambiguity that they did before. Development is much messier, much more individualized. Almost no one believes that these general algebraic structures crystallize at a certain point and can then be used for all kinds of content, even though the charm of the theory was this particular claim. We will talk about décalage at various times. Even Piaget realized that when a structure like conservation fell into place, it wasn't the case that one could immediately conserve in all spheres of life. He called that décalage. It was his fudge factor. However, people like my colleague Kurt Fischer have argued persuasively that décalage is the rule rather than the exception. What that means is rather than structures basically come into being with most stuff, and then a few things have to hop on the train later. In fact, the structure comes on with one thing, then with another, and the order is quite variable, and there's no real principle at work. Piaget relied a lot on kids' linguistic responses in his early studies, less and less as he got older, but in any case, it's quite clear that Piaget did not have any kind of understanding of how language works, nor did anybody else. That was really the work of the second part of the century, especially the work of Chomsky, which we'll come to later. And at that time, we'll also discuss a debate between Piaget and Chomsky, which I hope some of you will read, a very fascinating document. A very important limitation of Piaget, and I alluded to it when I said that his picture of 2 to 5 year olds was the most efficient, is that Piaget, because of the kind of tasks that he used and the way he interpreted them, systematically underestimated how competent infants and young children were. If you repeat Piaget's experiments exactly the way he did, you get the same results. He was a great scientist. However, once you begin to vary them in other ways, you see that often it was the particular oddity of how Piaget set up an experiment which led to the results. And so maybe it was cookies in the cookie jar or a particular kind of vessel which led to a certain response in conservation. And if you did the study differently, you get a different result. And that's the danger always of drawing a big conclusion from one or two studies. But Piaget was only one person, even though he eventually had an army of research assistants, and there's no way one person is going to be able to do all the studies that he or she wants to. We need to end with what is right about Piaget. There was a long period of Piaget bashing. I myself have spent most of my career arguing with Piaget, but I hope I never was a basher. I certainly didn't mean to be. I apologize if I was. But especially with the passage of time, people now realize, as they realize with Freud and Marx and other people who've been tremendously bashed, that they were very powerful thinkers, and most of us bashers were just little excrescences on their very formidable output. And I've just mentioned half a dozen things here. The notion that knowledge is biological, because we're biological creatures, and if it don't come from our genes and our brains, it ain't there at all. The constructivist view, which I think is the right way to think about learning and the right way for educators to think about what we're doing, but is terribly, terribly difficult for people to understand. And I fight in my own work, decades-long battles to make people understand that all knowledge, including understanding Piaget, has to be constructed. I can't give you a pill. I can't say, read this book and you'll know it. It requires really learning to think differently. A set of very important demonstrations, which are robust. We can all do them. If you bring me in a 4-year-old, I'll predict how they're going to do in all tasks, and I'll be right, unless we're dealing with a genius, in which case we'd have to see the child when it's 2 or 3. The clinical method: ask good questions, listen carefully, push the child, but don't ask leading questions. It would be easy to say every task is different, every domain is different, and many of us are often reduced to saying that, but Piaget at least tried to find general patterns, and science is the search for general patterns. And we couldn't do anything in science, and we didn't make some generalizations, and Piaget made interesting searches for these formal parallels or structures. And finally, Piaget was a psychologist, but he insisted in locating psychology in relation to other sciences and in relation to a biological, neurological point of view, a logical, mathematical point of view, and a philosophical point of view. Even though he didn't much like the philosophy of his day, all of his own questions came from Kant and other great philosophers. One can easily teach a course on just one aspect of Piaget. It's a fact of life, though a tragic one. We have exactly one lecture on Piaget. I hope that my continuing enthusiasm about this remarkable thinker has come through, and I hope most fervently that, beginning with the object concept, you will actually read some writings of Piaget, because you need to get it from the horse's mouth.